Follow me, did a jump.
I tried not to look.
Hit the gavel.
Good morning, everybody, and to those in the audience, the fans that are here, thank you for joining us for the, the J-Safe Task Force. I'm calling this meeting to order, the Joint Interim Task Force on Testing of Sexual Assault Forensic Evidence Kits. It is Wednesday, September 21st, 11 a.m. Thank you for being here. Our first order of business is an organizational meeting, so I am opening up an organizational meeting. Okay, so now that we're opened up, let's take a second to get to know each other. And so by way of introduction, I'll ask that I'll turn completely to my right and ask that you introduce yourself and say why you're here today.
I'm Patty Kenyon. I'm a sexual assault nurse from Linn County and Benton County. And I'm here because I have a passion for
excellent. Count on that. Thanks.
My name is Alex Gardner. I'm the captain and director of the Oregon State Police Crime Labs.
Michelle Roland-Schwartz. I'm executive director of the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force.
Excellent. Thank you.
I'm Deanna Horn. I am a criminal defense attorney, and I'm interested in getting this done right.
Appreciate it. I think we all are, so that's good.
Yes, I do.
And far down to the left.
Oh, all the way down here.
Okay. Yes.
I'm Danielle Tudor, and I am a victim advocate and activist. And so that's why I'm on this, as a victim representation.
And have been in that role for a long time.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. And you are very familiar with my case.
I am. Yes. Thank you.
I'm Belinda Beltran. I'm the Executive Director of Sexual Assault Support Services in Eugene. Our service area is Lane County. I go by BB, so Belinda is what my mom would call me when I'm in trouble, so please use BB, unless you really want to get my attention. And I'm just excited to be here and, you know, to see what we can do better in Oregon.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Mm-hmm. My name is Jim Bann. I'm the police chief of the city of Oregon City, and I'm here on behalf of the Chiefs of Police, Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police.
Excellent.
I'm Angela Donnelly. I am Senator Gelser's Chief of Staff and sitting in for her.
Excellent.
And I'm Rod Underhill, Multnomah County's District Attorney, here as representative both at my individual agency as well as me personally, but also on behalf of Oregon District Attorney's Association. And I guess I would summarize it with a broad array of kind of experience in this area.
Excellent. And for the person that's running the show, truly.
My name is Chana Newell. I'm counsel to the Judiciary Committees here in the legislature, and I'll be staffing this task force. Can you check the folks on the phone?
Oh, yeah. And who's with us on the phone?
I am Brenda Tracy. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Brenda.
Brenda Tracy. I'm a rape survivor and advocate, and had a lot to do with Senator Gelser in this bill, so I'm on the task force. Thanks.
Thank you.
And I'm George Burke. I'm commander of the Portland Police Bureau.
So, George, I will embarrass both of us acknowledging how old we each are now. George was a police explorer scout at the Gresham Police Department when I was a sergeant at the Gresham Police Department. So it's great to hear your voice.
You know what? I didn't know you were in the room, Carla. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That's perfectly fine. So, yes, I am Carla Paliso, state representative. 30 years with the Gresham Police Department. My last six as the chief. Now trying to do what we can do in Salem to make things a little better. So I appreciate everybody's attendance. And with that, I will ask for the adoption of the rules. D.A. Underhill, can you help with that, please?
Absolutely. Let me get my bearings on it and make sure I do this right. So I move to adopt the proposed task force rules. They are dated September 21st of 2016.
D.A. Underhill moves to adopt the proposed task force rules dated September 21st, 2016. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Hugh Fan.
Aye.
Linda Beltran?
Aye.
George Burke?
Aye.
Alex Gardner?
Aye.
Deanna Horn?
Aye.
Tricia Kenyon?
Aye.
Michelle Roland-Schwartz?
Aye.
Brenda Tracy?
Aye.
Danielle Tudor?
Aye.
Rod Underhill.
Aye.
Okay, hearing that, the motion passes, and the rules are adopted. Next up is the election of the chair. The chair calls the meetings and welds the gavel, directs the task force work. Can be any member, even a non-voting member. Is there anybody who would like to be the chair? Okay, now, not everybody at once.
See, we've all been involved in committees before.
That's right. That's right. Anybody have an interest?
You can do
that. Oh, well, okay,
then. Good sitting in front of
you. Ron Underhill nominates Representative Peluso to be our chair.
I'll second that.
Well, I'm flattered, and thank you. Are there any objections? Okay, so with hearing no objections, it passes. Okay.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, this is really important stuff, and I'm surrounded by the experts, so that will make my life very easy in this, and I, again, appreciate that. So.
Just need to close your organizational meeting and open an informational.
Okay. I will close the organizational meeting and open the informational meeting. I guess I'm supposed to read this. I am opening an informational hearing on a review of Senate Bill 1571 and the task force charge.
Chair Peluso, members of the committee, this is for the record, this is Chana Newell, and I will be walking through Senate Bill 1571. I'll probably keep this fairly brief, as most of you were very involved in this bill and its origination and its time walking through the legislature. I'll just touch on some highlights. This was drafted by Senator Gelser. It had 42 co-sponsors. That's an enormous amount of co-sponsors. This bill had support from day one in the building. It had unanimous support through the Judiciary Committee, through Joint Ways and Means, and unanimous votes on the House and Senate floor. It took effect on March 29, 2016. It has a couple of different sections in this bill that direct different entities to do different things. I provided you a handout that breaks it out by groups. So the first group is the Oregon State Police. The charge to the Oregon State Police is to test safe kits, an affirmative duty to test safe kits, to develop rules on prioritizing the testing of the kits, and to appoint a contact person for law enforcement agencies and victims concerning testing. Results are to be entered in CODIS as soon as practicable, and we'll be getting a report July 1, 2019 here in the Judiciary Committees to find out how that's working, whether any tweaks need to be made or updates, or whether sufficient progress is being made on that. Additionally, $1.5 million was given to OSP for increased staffing and capacity to do this testing. Moving on to local law enforcement agencies, they must develop a written policy and procedure for the collection of the kits and contact with victims, and they have to have this policy no later than January 1, 2017. The policies must be written and available to the public. The policies must include that kits are to be collected from the hospital within, or medical facility, it doesn't have to be a hospital, within 7 days of that kit being collected, and that it must be sent to OSP within 14 days. Now, if individual jurisdictions want to do this with a different timeline, they may, so long as it's shorter than that 7-day or 14-day period. So we don't want these languishing anywhere. At the same time, we don't want to hold up any law enforcement agency that wants to move faster. So that's why that was written that way. Kits that have been finished testing and anonymous kits, they must be held for 60 years. Local law enforcement may not submit anonymous kits for testing, and they must designate one person within the agency who can respond to requests for information from victims. So what we wanted to do here was give victims a way of finding information and not being shuffled around within an agency, and at the same time to let OSP do the work of testing without having to respond to numerous requests. So for our victim notification system, we had that the victims may request information on the status of the kit, the location, testing date, results, DNA matches, and an estimated destruction date of the kit. Law enforcement, that one person within the agency, must respond within 30 days of a request. They can decline to provide information if at that time it would interfere with an investigation or prosecution. A victim may designate in writing that another person can access that information. So if the victim doesn't want to do it directly, they can give permission to another person to get that information for them. And the victim can request that a non-anonymous kit become an anonymous kit, so long as it hasn't been tested yet. Or if they have an anonymous kit and they want it to be tested, they can make that switch as well. And then we have a charge to medical facilities that they must notify law enforcement within 7 days of collection of a kit. The second part of our bill, that was all in the first three or four sections. The last part is our task force. And I'm going to go through a brief overview of what it looks like and some of the interesting things about it. We have 16 members total, four legislators, and 12 appointed by the governor. That's most of you here today. We currently have two open positions. So if you have a friend, you know someone who might be interested, we are looking for a person who has experience seeking and applying for grants. And we are looking for a person representing law enforcement agencies in rural jurisdictions. So, putting that out there, we still have two open positions here. We'd love to see folks. Interestingly, on this task force, at least from my perspective, our legislative members are non-voting members, which means that when we come to adopting a final report, the legislators don't actually vote on it, and they don't count for our quorum. So today we might have gotten into a little trouble with three of our legislative members missing, but it's actually okay because they don't count towards our quorum. So that's just a little interesting thing, and occasionally we might have to stop and remind ourselves because it's very different from other ways we do this. We'll probably try to schedule 5 to 6 meetings over the next year to keep this work going, but we do have a legislative session starting in February that will go through July, and that will hamper the work of this task force when we're in the, you know, the full swing of session. It will be very difficult for this task force to meet. We may try to do that, and we'll work with the chair to set up a schedule that will work for everyone. One decision we'll need to make is whether we want to schedule those meetings in advance now, or whether we want to schedule them a month or two in advance of each meeting. So we could set 6 meetings at one point in time and everyone hold that meeting, but that doesn't leave a lot of flexibility 6 or 8 or 9 months down the road. So be thinking on how scheduling would work best for you all. We've done our chairperson. We've talked about a quorum. This is a public entity, so we abide by public record laws and public meeting laws. We do have to post notice if we are going to have a quorum that is going to discuss the business of this task force. So if a group of 6 or more of you are going to get together and talk about what the task force is doing, we should probably notice that. Okay. So just keep that in mind. Small group discussions are great. Please do discuss in small groups, but be careful that if you're, you know, all at a conference, that we'd be careful not to be talking too much about the work of the task force. Staffing is provided by myself and Mike Riley, but all state agencies are directed to assist here. So any assistance we need from anyone else, if we need OSP to come in and give us information, they're directed to do that. Same with DOJ, any other state body we can do. We must complete our charge by July 31 of 2018. And submit a report to the legislature no later than December 1, 2018. And on this handout, I have the session dates there for you. Those are kind of blackout dates for us, times we won't be getting much work done in this task force. So that's my summary of the measure.
Any questions or discussion around that?
Is a quorum 6?
I believe it's 6 because we're missing the 2 non-voting members. So you have 10, quorum would be 5 or more.
Any other questions or comments? All right, then let's move on to
why don't I touch briefly on the charge of the task force? There are 6 main charges that were put forward here. And I'm just going to read them verbatim here from the bill for you. And there's someone on the phone that we'd like to have mute their line, please. Thank you. We are to examine the process for gathering and analyzing sexual assault forensics evidence kits. We're to examine and identify improvements for law enforcement training on responding to and investigating sexual assaults. Examine and identify improvements for victim access to evidence other than sexual assault forensic evidence kits, including but not limited to police reports and other physical evidence. Examine and identify possible procedures for testing of anonymous kits. Yes?
Shannon, this is Brenda. I think someone has their cell phone, like, not on mute because I'm having a really hard time hearing.
Mr. Burke, would you mind muting your cell phone?
Sure.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Yep, absolutely.
Now I'm fine. Hold on for a second.
Okay. Examine and identify additional rights of victims concerning the sexual assault forensic evidence kit testing process, and identifying pursuing grants and under other funding sources in order to eliminate the backlog of untested sexual assault forensic evidence kits. I grouped these into four categories that I think are pertinent here. One is victim access and rights, the process of collecting and testing safe kits, law enforcement responses and investigations, and grant and funding opportunities. So I think those can be distilled. They perhaps could be even more. But for a starting point, those are our four main things that we're looking at. And then they break down a little bit further.
Okay, questions, comments? All righty. Okay, so let's talk about identification of goals and the outline for moving forward. Again, let's make this a discussion item, see what people think are the highest priorities and how we need to move forward.
So I'll begin at least with that, with an idea that's in my mind. So, and I don't know that this qualifies as the highest priority or that kind of thing, but I certainly want to put on the table for this group to examine the definition as found in Senate Bill 1571, Melissa's bill, the definition of anonymous kit. That is a very important definition, as it is critical to many things as it relates to the bill, many practices as it relates to jurisdictions and such. By way of just another sentence or two, just to tee it up, and I don't want to, you know, now is not necessarily the time to have a full-blown conversation about it, but for us to orient ourselves and at some point revisit it. The definition of anonymous kit currently in 1571 reads, a sexual assault forensic evidence kit collected from a victim who either has not made a decision whether or not to participate in the prosecution of the perpetrator of the sexual assault, or has chosen not to participate in the prosecution of the perpetrator of the sexual assault. That definition is different than at least the genesis of the bill. The genesis of the bill, as I understand it, written by Ms. Swanson, which I had here a moment ago. But essentially, that definition then read what we commonly understand to be the Jane Doe kits in the state of Oregon. Those kits where the sexual assault victim did not report to law enforcement. So one issue with respect to this is, at least for dialogue, is are we, by virtue of this definition, going to subsequently create another backlog into our future? Just by way of, as when we move into some comments about the Danny grant and the process that's going on with the backlog as it relates to Multnomah County, Marion County, and Lane County, this language, when the bill was being voted on, would have, if not critically, impacted the Danny grant and our ability to move forward, if not critically, potentially, clearly have a ramification. So as a result of that, it was actually read into legislative history by Senator Gelser, among, I think, others, but certainly Senator Gelser, language to the effect that this language in Senate Bill 1571 is not intended to impact the DANI grant process, nor the BJA grant that had been received up in by the city of Portland. So a lot more dialogue about that. What does it mean? Drill down, but I just want to tee it up as an issue for us to at some point revisit.
I can, if I could, I have another dimension to add to that for people to ponder. In the lab, we struggled with how to manage the cases that come in, the cases in which there's a minor victim who asks to have the case not prosecuted, often because she's frightened of the process for obvious reasons, and the advocating parent who feels strongly that the case should be tested. It's difficult to manage that on a case-by-case basis because you could have a victim who's 5 or 12 or 17, and the considerations are different in each of those cases. And then the other dimension that I wanted to mention is the developmentally delayed victim. And I can tell you that until the legislature provides clarification, the way we are resolving that is to apply the anonymous definition to any mentally competent adult, basically. So if the victim is 18 or older and mentally competent, then the victim's wishes are going to be honored. And if it's in that ambivalent area, we're going to default to testing.
Let me also add, if I might, just while we're on the topic before we move off, I have met with and had conversations with Tom and Mary Bittler. It's their daughter, Melissa, who's Melissa's law, Melissa Bittler. So I met with Tom and Mary. I had this pointed conversation with them, as I have with many other aspects of things, but I had this pointed conversation on this very point. And they support and encourage. I mentioned that I wanted to have this conversation with this task force, bring up this issue, have us revisit it, and they completely support what I believe are some concerns surrounding that definition as we move forward, whether we can or should explore a fix, if you will, legislative fix to that aspect of things. And just by way of, if you're looking at the bill and you want to find out where it is, it's Section 2, Sub 1. It's right at the very beginning of things. And the first definition, quote unquote, anonymous kid.
Go ahead. So, are we testing all rape kits that come in from here on out? Or if anonymous being a victim that has decided not to move forward, are we still testing their kit now after with the passage of this law?
So, was that Danielle?
Yes, yeah.
This is George. Just as it stands right now, if it doesn't fit the definition that's currently in the bill, then my understanding is we are not submitting those. If we do submit them, we're getting them sent back to us with the information that those qualify as anonymous kits, which is really kind of the genesis behind this conversation. What we found, taking a look at the data itself, is that we're really only going to get from the backlog, that would eliminate about half of the kits that we have in inventory, which is why, DA Underhill, I think we talked about the impacts of what this would have done to us for the grant process, or the grant issues. If we continue with the language the way that it is, we're going to continue to have this backlog of kits that meet the state definition for this process, which is going to just continue to cause us problems down the road. We're going to continue to have untested kits that qualify as that should be submitted that are not being submitted because of the definition.
Okay. Did Senator?
Well, and this is Brenda Tracy, but I think from the very beginning when I've been speaking with Senator Gelser about this glitch in the bill, and Jackie Swanson, who helped write the bill, and Tom and Mary Bittler, it's been our intention and our hope that we would fix this this next session with the definition of the anonymous kit. So it was not supposed to be written that way in the first place. It happened. but I'd like to see it fixed, and everyone that I worked with on the bill, I think, wants to see it fixed also.
Yes, I think every head is nodding in support of that.
Right.
Can I get a clarification? Yeah. I have not been involved with any of this until now. So does that mean that if a victim said, this happened, I do not want a prosecution taking place, would the intent, or do some people want that kit tested anyway?
Yes. They're preserving their options. So essentially they have the option. They can have the evidence collected and then determine at a later date if they want to pursue any type of criminal investigation and participate in that. So that's, okay, I think, what we're talking about.
I'm just trying to...
So we have a...
Catch up to...
If I might add to what Bibi said. So we have, and I have had for a number of years now, what is in the kind of business, this Jane Doe option.
Right.
So I'm going to overly simplify it, but just to get bearings, and anybody can correct my oversimplification if I get it wrong. But essentially, a victim of a sexual assault can go into a medical facility, whether that, you know, and receive a safe kit examination and have that preserved anonymously under a Jane Doe. That's what we call it, Jane Doe, where law enforcement is not conducting an active investigation because of that victim's in-the-moment desires. But the evidence is going to be preserved because that victim may very well change their mind subsequent to that physical examination. And so let's just jump ahead. A week later, that mind does get changed, and law enforcement is contacted and begins to do their investigation. We will uncloak the Jane Doe because she requested it, right? Alternatively, how this bill is currently written relative to its, and so let me finish another thought and then move to what this bill says, just to really kind of drill down and tease out this distinction. It was originally written by Ms. Swanson and others that worked on it, that the anonymous kit, and I'm now looking at the original, what Jackie had submitted, the anonymous kit refers to sexual assault forensic examination evidence collected from sexual assault victims who do not report the crime to law enforcement, i.e., in the business for all of us, i.e., Jane Doe kits. That language got changed now and currently reads, as I said earlier, but just to highlight the distinction, it includes those who have not made a decision or those who have indicated not to participate. Well, just by way of example, that can sometimes result in wrongdoer, meaning the perpetrator making threats, the perpetrator, you know, and essentially hamstringing any subsequent meaningful investigation that could be done by just simply saying, and I'm going to figuratively say, and maybe literally, gun to the head, call that police officer and say you don't want to have your kit tested. And then we're shut down by operation of the language of this statute. We're effectively shut down. And so, and that adds to the examples that Alex raised relative to certain children and the impacts of those. So we are creating, as we sit here, we are beginning to create a second set of backlogs by virtue of the existing language that I would like to have us have a conversation about a fix.
So, Rod, I'm sorry if I'm a little naive about.
But, so what I'm hearing saying is that we need to test these anonymous kits so we don't have a backlog later, and so that we're preserving evidence for later. But also the law requires that those results go into CODIS. Mm-hmm. And so I can't imagine that your office wouldn't prosecute if you get a CODIS hit.
So I can clarify there. It requires CODIS-eligible cases, okay, to go into CODIS. And just because we have a profile doesn't mean it's CODIS-eligible. There has to be a basis for a crime, right? And if you have no victim identified, you have no crime. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, there's a crime, but we don't have any way of proceeding on the crime. There's no way to...
So you would test it to get a profile, but you would not submit it into CODIS. Would just have the profile.
Yeah, it has to meet the FBI's very rigid CODIS criteria, and that includes a basis for a crime, that a crime has been committed.
So, and I guess then as a side note, that just terrifies me. Yes, I'm a criminal defense attorney, but I'm also a woman. That just terrifies me that if you have a good, if you've got a DNA profile that looks like a valid DNA profile, and you can't put it into CODIS because this is an anonymous kit, but you could possibly identify the rapist by that. I mean, that just, so there we go. I'm terrified.
But I think it's really important to not lose sight of the fact that this is an individual survivor and it's their decision. So I think that whether they pursue or not pursue law enforcement is up to them. So when we say it's anonymous or a Jane Doe kit, we actually have to mean that. So for them to like have their kit tested later down the road without their consent, I just feel like would be hugely problematic for survivors.
So I hear
and also the trust with the system.
So I hear that maybe there's possibly two competing sort of things going on here. Is that here's Rod and Mr. Gardner, can I call you Alex?
Alex works for
that. Okay. Here's Rod and Alex saying like, wow, we're going to create another backlog for ourselves with these anonymous kits. They're going to sit there. Nobody's going to test them. Mm-hmm. And that's problematic because it takes storage space and whatever.
And I understand what you're
saying.
And then there's
a little bit of the competing. So that's kind of the law enforcement side of things.
Right.
And then there's the competing victims' interest side of things, saying like, I just don't even want that information out there.
Well, and you test that kit. Aren't we then dealing with statute of limitations then? If a perpetrator is identified, aren't you on a time clock for a prosecution once you know who that offender is?
Well, so let me back up and say,
it's the investigation.
I am not supporting the testing of all kits. I am 100% supporting the retention mm-hmm. of the Jane Doe application of not testing that body of work that we're talking about, those kits.
Okay. Absolutely.
When it's other than that, when it has been reported to law enforcement, then we move forward and we test all kits. When it's been reported to law enforcement, we've activated your statute of limitations statute when that report to law enforcement occurs. And that's what I'm saying. So I think we're now saying, I think we're now meeting minds and saying the same thing. We're not testing Jane Doe, those who are not reported to law enforcement. Philosophically, I agree with that 100%. Those who remain Jane Doe and they don't get tested unless or until she or he, this victim of the sexual assault, changes their mind and wants to change it from Jane Doe to an identified victim, right? And then subsequently then moves into that second category.
So what you're saying, though, is that you're going to test the rape kit of a woman who calls 911, says I was raped, goes to the hospital, has a rape kit done, and then says, wait, I don't want to prosecute. But that rape kit's going to get tested because it was reported to law enforcement, even though she doesn't want to go forward with prosecution.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just clarifying.
Okay.
And that's what's occurring now when we get into dialogue about the details of the Danny Grant and BJ and the conversation around the country. That's what's occurring in this jurisdiction and beyond.
And I'm sorry, I talk with my hands.
It'll be fine.
As I'm catching up and my questions, just because I really don't know anybody at this table, my biggest concerns as I'm thinking about what everybody's saying are two things, and they're both formed by years as a detective working these cases. One, well, and they're all about the victim. They're all about the victim's perspective and sitting in usually an emergency room trying to explain to somebody who is going through absolute hell all these decisions about, oh, okay, I understand you don't want to be, we're going to test the kid anyways, and so how we recommend training to law enforcement is crucial because it's a very confusing time for victims, and so we need to make sure that there's clarity even in the verbiage of what we're suggesting. The other thing I'm sensitive to is a case in particular where I remember somebody at one point came in and said, you know, I was raped a long time ago and now I want to do something about it, and to say sorry, we can't, you know, we're not going to be able to do anything right now. That's a horrible thing to say. So that is what is ringing in my ears. I'm just trying to get clarification, and I only say that so you know why I'm asking questions.
To my awareness, and back to the I guess, the national conversation, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but in an attempt to summarize some of the psychology behind this, is a fair assessment that part of why we have a backlog is because of individual decision-making at the law enforcement point, right?
Yeah, it's part of it.
And at the prosecutor point on some occasions. And that is a choice by a detective to either submit or not submit based on a subjective analysis of whether they believe this is actually a sexual assault, or on some occasions, as I'm aware of, or a belief that they made this up, right? And so that kit goes on the shelf and becomes part of the backlog nature. And so the national conversation, recognizing that that happens, unfortunately not infrequently, made essentially a, we're going to use the term, I think it's forklift. We're going to take all these backlog kits other than Jane Doe's, although not every state has a Jane Doe statute, but we're going to take it out of the hands of subjectivity, and we're going to test them all. And that's where, as we move into, one of the agenda items is a discussion of specifically the Danny grant that Multnomah County has received and what that is and what it means, but also that parallels some of the psychology behind where the grant money comes from and the reason why, and maybe it makes sense to add a comment or two, because the obligation, referring to the Danny grant, the obligation was that we did not have any subjectivity in which ones get tested or not. I'm going to overly simplify it by saying it's asking an agency, how many do you have? And then we supply an answer. How many backlog kits do you have? And that's supplying an answer. And as it relates to Portland, we originally, round number, close to 2,000. And then the next part of the inquiry is, okay, send them all. When we get into the definition of anonymous kit, that's where we were, the obligation in order for us to be a recipient of the grant and do that body of work was to send them all and begin the work of backlog analysis of, again, round number 2,000. With this definition, creates a different response to send them all, and we would have immediately been in violation of our grant obligations of sending them all. That's where the senator was willing to put into legislative history that despite this language, is recognized that this is not intended to impact Multnomah County's Danny grant obligations, and that the processing and testing of those would proceed as planned. Again, I'm simplifying and summarizing, but and so we are, we're working in that area, but simultaneously, for the reasons that we've all been talking about, we are creating, as we speak, another backlog scenario that as we move forward.
So, Rod, the other problem with that is that the created subjectivity that gets put into whether the victim is willing or not willing, and is there an apprehension?
Yes.
And that should not be at the moment where a victim is reporting a crime and law enforcement is there taking a report. That information could be completely subjective from the person taking the information at the time. And that's why, the problem with identifying that piece of the legislation or that part of the definition being potentially unwilling really causes us a problem, because there is a lot of indecision at that point. And if there is indecision, then we kind of have our hands tied as to what we can do.
Yeah. Quite frankly, George, I think when we have indecision, it falls into section one of that paragraph, which says they have not made a decision whether or not to participate. That indecision equals that, which then determines that it does not get tested. That's your creating of a new backlog. So I don't want to tie up all of this group's time with that. I think we've, at least in my mind, we've flushed it out. I think we certainly stuff to go back and do your own research, look into certainly those who will want to follow it up, more than willing to talk with individuals or others.
Well, I think it's legislatively going to be taken care of this next session, right? A definition between Jane Doe and anonymous. So hopefully...
That's one of the goals.
Yeah, yeah.
And with that, I think we have a good segue into our third informational hearing on the Safe Kit backlog. So I would like to call DA Rod Underhill, Michelle Roland Schwartz, and Captain Alex Gardner to the dais, or from here, whichever you would prefer.
It's a little bit easier to speak, if that's all right with you,
yes.
Chair. To probably move
yes,
there.
Please.
Yes.
All right.
Again, welcome, and please be sure to state your name for the record.
Great. Chair Peluso and members of the task force, my name is Michelle Roland Schwartz, Executive Director with the Sexual Assault Task Force. And just by way of introduction, we are a statewide nonprofit organization with 100 multidisciplinary members, 9 staff, and 20 instructors who provide training, technical assistance, and do policy work to advance our improvement of our response and prevention of adult and adolescent sexual assault across Oregon. I was asked to come today and provide some context for why we are here. What is the national conversation? What has brought us to this point where we're having conversations about how to test sexual assault kits efficiently? And so I'd like to ground us with one of the first communities that identified this as an issue. I'm going to be talking about Detroit a lot, and I know we're in Oregon, but I think we have so many other communities who have paved the way and have identified issues, are doing research that we can learn a lot from. And it also speaks to the fact that this is not an issue that's unique to Oregon. This is a national issue and something that all communities are grappling with. So I'm going to walk you through a timeline, and it's only 4 slides, so I'll be brief. But initially, Detroit identified that they had over 11,000 kits in a warehouse and wondered, how did this happen? And so a group of multidisciplinary team came together and did what is called the Detroit Action Research Project, which unveiled there were over 11,000 kits and identified in their research some of the risk factors for the backlog. Rod spoke to one of those risk factors earlier, and we'll get to what those look like in a later slide. And then it begged the question, what about backlogs in other communities? And so we have slowly seen, Louisiana, Houston, New York, and other communities that are doing an audit of their own backlog. The reality is we actually don't know the number of untested kits across the country. One of the charges of the Joyful Heart Foundation was to really kind of track and to hold states accountable to the backlog and really pushed for legislation, which is why we, along with many advocates across the state, why we have Melissa's Law Now. We, of course, were asked to do an audit as a state, I believe it was last year, and identified 5,200 untested kits. I know that some of those are anonymous, others are not. And about that time started to see the rollout of a variety of funding sources, including the District Attorney of New York and the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, which I will let others speak to. One of the other issues that came up in this process was recognizing that we are re-engaging victims after many, many years of not having any contact with the system, and learn from other states that notification may have gone well. Some victims may have been pleased to get a knock on their door after 10 or more years. And we learned that others experienced, an increase in trauma or experienced a re-traumatization. Maybe they have children now. Maybe their partner who, they have a partner who didn't know that this happened to them. And so there are a variety of really sensitive issues that we need to be aware of as we do survivor notification. The Joyful Heart Foundation has done some research around that. Focus groups with victims to talk about what works and doesn't work, and have unveiled their navigating notification just this year. We've had those conversations with statewide partners about how we want that approach to look like, again, learning from those other communities. Moving into some of the risk factors, we talk about going back to the Detroit Action Research Project, some of the risk factors that they identified. And the first is the no protocol or procedures. And kind of going back to what Rod said earlier, you have no protocol in cases that determine what should happen in the kits. And so you had individuals making decisions on kits on an individual basis. And they made those decisions a lot. And so we had, this pretty hefty backlog of kits across the country. The second was just not enough person power. There were not enough DNA analysts, not enough prosecutors, not enough law enforcement, not enough people to help move cases along. And I know that we've seen a lot of strides, particularly in the last year, in getting some additional funding. But this is one of the things that they identified as a risk factor. Frequent leadership turnover. And in Detroit, they identified that every 2 years, not only was the chief of police, but all the way down to the supervising, the supervisor of the sex crimes unit, that about every 2 years there was turnover. So there was really not a long period of someone in the position for a long period of time, one, to identify that there was a problem, and two, to remedy the problem. You may have identified it, but you're not in the position long enough to really remedy it. So that was one of the other issues they identified. Fourth is this poor medical-legal relationship. And I think that we have seen a lot of improvement in our medical-legal response to sexual assault, an understanding of the healthcare provider's role in doing the exam, and that that's very different than the investigation. But I think that we have a lot to learn, and there's some applicability to us here in Oregon based on what they identified in Detroit. And then the last was insufficient advocacy. In a lot of cases, not having the advocate present during the exam and being able to be with the victim to do follow-up care and help ask questions and help provide that advocacy, victims would go home and didn't really have that connection with someone. So those were the primary risk factors I identified. We're seeing some other things come up. One is the focus, historically the focus on stranger sexual assaults. And Detroit, again, is kind of on the lead with this. And so often what we would see is a real focus on the relationship of the perpetrator to the victim. And if this was a stranger or an unknown perpetrator, wanting to prioritize testing those kits for obvious reasons. But the research that they're coming out with in Detroit recently released is when they tested kits where the relationship was known or unknown to the victor, to the victim, the CODIS hits were equivalent. And so there's a lot to be said about testing those kits where the perpetrator is known or has a personal relationship to the victim. And then the other, and I think that we've all talked a little bit about this today, is just our backdrop to how we respond to victims of sexual assault. Really a lack of understanding about dynamics of sexual assault, the dynamics within the relationship between the victim and the perpetrator. And then also a lack of understanding about the neurobiological response to trauma. What are we seeing when we're responding to the hospital? What is the victim presenting with that either makes them appear credible or not? So those are really, I think, some of the key contributing factors. I'd like to just leave us with kind of grounding us in the encounter for victims. I know that we are tasked with what we do with these kits, but I'd like to I guess widen our scope a bit and think about what the purpose of the medical forensic exam is, the role of the SANE, and what it means for victims. And so thinking about this as a broader healthcare encounter for victims of sexual assault, and it's also why having the anonymous report as we originally understood it is so critical. But recognizing that a sexual assault nurse examiner, as a registered nurse or other medical provider who is specially trained to provide comprehensive care to the patient who's experienced sexual assault, and being reminded that their feet are firmly planted in being a healthcare provider. Their focus is on the patient. Their focus is to ensure that they're, you know, addressing issues of health and well-being, to reduce long-term negative physical and mental health outcomes, and that they're an unbiased provider in this process. They are not an arm of the law. The other piece of the medical forensic exam, I think that we tend to really focus on the envelope and the kit itself, and I understand that importance, but also thinking about the medical forensic exam as broader than that. And so that's the SANE is getting a medical history, just like when we go in to get our medical treatment. You know, you go in with stomach pain. That is something that you're providing to your healthcare provider. They're getting your history or your medical history. So they're taking that patient history. They're doing a head-to-toe exam, a detailed genital exam. And those are all the medical aspects of this encounter. And all the while preserving evidence, documenting, you know, injury. And that's the role of the kit in this process. So just to recap, that this is a critical access point to healthcare services for victims, that keeping the anonymous definition as we originally kind of conceived of it, that you go in and you can get a medical forensic exam, get your healthcare needs met while also preserving evidence if you decide at a later date to move forward, is really important. And then just to end with having the sexual assault nurse examiner and the advocate present during that encounter is best practice. It mitigates trauma and improves long-term health and well-being. So thank you. I'm certainly open to questions, but I want to turn it over to my partners here.
Can I ask you one question? Yes. About something you said? There was something that you had said about the survivor notification that they had learned and kind of the, it had created trauma for some people, and how, if there's a lot of information, just tell me where to go look at it, because I'm interested to see. That's an important thing.
Absolutely. I'm happy to send it either through Chana or just via email. There are a couple of links, but if you were to Google Joyful Heart Foundation, navigating notification, you can get a summary. The task force also put together a recommendation for Oregon and considerations that we would want to make in notification, whether we're calling them first, whether we're knocking on their door first, why maybe sending something in the mail or email is probably not the route we want to take, obviously because of privacy issues, but I'm happy to send that out as well.
I can just look it
up.
Yeah,
a quick Google search will get you there.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Well, I'll go ahead and teed up a little bit of my remarks as they relate to the DANI grant and the BJA grant that our jurisdiction has received, and kind of the background a little bit behind that, as well as what is the body of work that we're using. I should back up and say my name is Rod Underhill, member of the task force, but also district attorney in Multnomah County. And by way of just a brief summary of background, I've been a prosecutor now here in a couple weeks. It'll be 28 years. A decade of which was spent doing nothing but domestic violence-related investigation, prosecutions. Of course, that's where I met our chair, then law enforcement officer and later chief with the Gresham Police Department. That's Carla Peluso. She was also assigned to that body of work, and we worked together in that area. That effort, together with other
more classic stranger upon stranger related sexual assaults, work in the area of child abuse, certainly in the area of sexual assault related child abuse work. Many, many aspects of things that have helped frame my thinking relative to this conversation, in addition to having two daughters. And so I also have, I suppose, another somewhat unique aspect to this, and that is I prosecuted the killer of Melissa Bittler, and so became intimately familiar with, not only with that case, of course, quite unfortunately, but Melissa's parents, Tom and Mary Bittler. And they continue to be honored by the fact that Melissa's death is now resulting in, you know, a positive thing for our community. Despite that, they're frustrated, as many of us were, to learn of the magnitude of the backlog that exists in our state. And that comes about, a little bit of that genesis of the grant application deals a little bit with some of that background. We've referenced Detroit, and I have the fortune of knowing Kim Worthy. She's the district attorney of Detroit. I've had a handful of conversations with her about her backlog experience, and from the very beginning, when she began to realize that they existed, and sharing her story. I am also colleagues with Tim McGinty out of Cleveland, Ohio, as they've tackled their backlog as well, and Cy Vance out of Manhattan, and I'll circle around and talk to him here in a bit. And a little bit of that is the genesis of in conversations with that group, specifically those individuals, as they shared their tales around the country of their experiences and their unfortunate backlogs that they were working through and beginning to work through. The conversation came around to Oregon and Multnomah County. And for certain reasons, I had in my mind that we had a much better meaning, less backlog problems, challenges in Oregon than actually existed. And so I had that conversation with this group of national prosecutors as they were tackling this mostly on the East Coast, so to speak. And upon my return, this is early 2014, upon my return, began to inquire, look into things, together with George Burke, who's on the phone. George, I imagine you're still here. Not hearing him, but he's probably muted because we asked him to. George Burke was working commander of the Sexual Assault Detail, Portland Police Bureau, and we began having conversations in early 2014. In fact, they called a meeting of all the law enforcement officers, the chiefs, and the sheriff from Multnomah County into my office to have a conversation on this very topic in early 2014. So I had the chief of police from Portland, I had the sheriff from Multnomah County, the Gresham chief of police, Fairview, and Troutdale at that time. And all of us began to have a conversation. It was a great conversation in that it was a quick, we have discovered that we do have an existing backlog. My position was, we're going to do something about it, and we're going to do it on our watch, we're going to do it now, we're going to fix it. Who's with me? And I'll just summarize by saying everybody in the room was instantly all hands on deck. Job two was resources, and it's a broad array of resource impacts. It's not just police. It's not just Oregon State Police Forensic Lab, right, and the impacts on that. There's just a broad array of resources that are impacted. And so job two, once we got the philosophical part out of the way, which was gratefully quick, then it was, we need to find some resources to help us get this job done. And so because of those conversations I'd had at the national level, I was aware that the District Attorney of New York, specifically Cy Vance, that's the Danny Grant, DA New York, was putting together a national solicitation for, if I'm remembering right, about $38 million made available to jurisdictions around the country. The maximum you could apply for / qualify for was $2 million. And so if you do the quick math, there's going to be about 16 to 20 jurisdictions in all likelihood that would receive funds in order to begin to work through, clear their backlog. Simultaneous with that was the Bureau of Justice Administration, BJA, was offering a simultaneous grant. They were working together, they meaning Danny and BJA, they were having conversations together, making sure that they're not duplicating efforts and such, lots of conversations. And essentially the BJA grant was not to pay for the testing, the lab testing, but instead to pay for advocacy, to pay for investigative work downstream, that once you get these results back, we're going to have a whole nother body of work that needs to be done, prosecution function, investigative function, advocacy function. So they were divided up, I'm overly simplifying it, but in two big buckets. BJA also had essentially a cap on what a jurisdiction could apply for and receive, and that also was about $2 million. So we divided, in the summarizing the Multnomah County experience, we divided up obligations. The City of Portland, George's office and the leadership in the Portland Police Bureau took on the obligation of lead with respect to the BJA grant. Remember, that's applying for certain advocacy services to be run out of that agency, together with investigative services as well as prosecution. And then my office, I volunteered to take the lead on the DANI grant aspect of things. And remember, that's to pay for the actual testing of backlog kits. So in order to, one, be, I think, competitive at the national level for a grant, as well as wanting to address not just Multnomah County's backlog, but my awareness that the entire state and other jurisdictions had backlogs as well. I essentially had two, I'm overly simplifying, but two primary motivations for reaching out to Marion County and Lane County. So let me, with respect to the DANI grant application, so let me summarize by saying I knew, by virtue of homework that we had done, that for about $2 million, we could test about 3,000 backlog kits relative to the price that we would expect to pay as far as just the sheer dollar amount. So Multnomah County's examination, both the City of Portland and then the other jurisdictions that I mentioned, again, I'm going to round number it. We were given numbers in the neighborhood of about 2,000 backlog kits, most of which existed with the Portland Police Bureau, but some in other jurisdictions. So again, a round number, about 2,000 kits. So I knew that if we received $2 million, we could still do an additional body of work. So that had me reach out to then District Attorney of Lane County, Alex Gardner, and ask Alex to give me a sense of what the backlog exists in Lane County. And at the time, again, using a round number, the answer was about 400. I then put a call into Alex, Walt Beglau, the Marion County District Attorney, same question. And the answer was about the same as well, about 400 there as well. It didn't take any urging, nudging. It didn't take any deep dive conversations, both Walt and Alex, when I called them to ask them this question and to ask them if they wanted to participate in our effort to begin to eliminate the backlogs in our jurisdictions. They were quick with a yes. So both those two jurisdictions joined me as we continued to take the lead. So my application on the DANI grant included, in a round number, 27, 28, 2900, that range of things relative to these three counties now, that I thought, number one, fit my philosophical goal, which was to assist the state, not just Multnomah County, in eliminating their backlog, together with presenting, frankly, an application that was going to be unique, that was going to be different than any that they'd seen. In fact, including more than half of the state's existing backlog in one application. The other grants were just jurisdictional only, like Multnomah County only or Lane County only, and that kind of thing. I like to think that approach was both a good idea tactically and a good idea philosophically. I can tell you this, it was successful. So we received just a few dollars shy of $2 million from DANY relative to the grant process. Simultaneously, Portland was notified by BJA that they'd received over $1 million. With a lens towards recognizing that we were going to do this backlog and pay for the kits, but then we had this entire body of work investigatively, prosecution, advocacy, that needed to be funded as well. And so they worked in concert with one another back on the East Coast, we received those rewards. So then we needed to get back to work. I shouldn't overlook, because it's critically important, that ongoing conversations were occurring with the Oregon State Police and the superintendent, Superintendent Evans at the time, and long conversations about, hey, I don't want my backlog to become your backlog, meaning I can take these kits, literally, the tangible kits, drive them down to a state crime lab and put them on their shelves, only to have them have a backlog because they don't have the resources. So we worked together with leaders in the legislature and made them aware of our efforts and our work. And I think we were successful. I know we were successful in getting some additional resources for the Oregon State Police Crime Lab that was going to allow them, because there's also training and time to get started and all that stuff. But it allowed them to get additional resources to hire people literally to do this work. I probably, in describing this to you, led you to believe that we were taking the kits physically and taking them directly to the Oregon State Crime Lab. But the Danny Grant required us to use an outside lab sourcing. So we put together a solicitation, my office did, and had a competitive analysis bid, did a lot of research, and all overly summarized by saying we selected Sorensen Lab out of Utah, which is a very highly reputable lab that is doing this testing of essentially the 2,800 kits. We're in process of doing it. I checked with my team just yesterday to get the most recent update. And we are receiving, essentially how they go now is the kits, they come off the backlog status. They go to Utah, to Sorensen Lab. They are analyzed. Upon the completion of that, the results of that are forwarded to the Oregon State Police Crime Lab for that CODIS review and other detailed material that no doubt Mr. Gardner here is going to be better at summarizing for you and explaining. The physical kits, of course, get returned to the parent agency. And then after, back to Oregon State Police Crime Lab, after they're done with their insertion into CODIS, their review and such, the results, if you will, come back to me, figuratively. They come back to our investigators, prosecutors and such, for what does this mean? What did you find out and what does it mean? We're beginning. We've received approximately 200 of those have made themselves their way back now to our jurisdiction, and we're doing that body of work, which is interpreting what does this mean, and follow-up and investigation or any of the above. And so there's a body of work that's being done as we speak on kits that began to get sent off to Utah here a handful of months ago. Now, a little bit more about what does that look like in my office, and I can summarize what it looks like in the law enforcement side. So I think because of the seriousness I hope is conveyed to others, I put together a team within my office. So I have specifically designated one prosecutor. Her name is Amity Gert. She's been assigned to this project now almost a year. She comes with a broad background in the area of prosecution of domestic violence, sexual assaults, child abuse, and such, and was a perfect selection to be my boots on the ground lead prosecutor in this area. I have no confusion in my mind that she will quickly become inundated with probably an awful lot of work when the other 1,800 or so begin to come back to our jurisdiction. So trust me when I say she's not alone. She's just a point guard, and she's going to become the field general here soon. Luckily, I have other resources within my office, and we will get the job done. But I added to that a specifically designated victim advocate, Kim Phillips Clark. She has been an advocate with my office for a very long time, is highly experienced, and she is 100% assigned to this project, in part thankful to the VOCA funding that all of us have seen a recent increase in. Lastly, and maybe most uniquely, I guess, is I hired a retired forensic scientist, formerly from the Oregon State Police Crime Lab, and named Susan Horman. She spent her career doing this body of work, doing the testing. She was one of those individuals that would be called to sexual assault trials, to murder trials and such, to talk about the DNA analysis. She was the person doing that work. She retired from the Oregon State Police Crime Lab. She and I have a long relationship of working on these kind of cases over the years, and I hastily hired her, and she is working on this body of work for me and makes up the third person as far as a dedicated team of individuals within my office, making sure that we get this right. One of the first tasks I had them do was prepare protocols. written protocols for our own body of work. This is before the existence of Melissa's law. And we have, and more than willing to share, we share it with anybody who expresses even a remote amount of interest in it. A handbook on the body of work that I've attempted to summarize. It's a 23-page handbook that is a bit of a, here's what we do, you know, step by step. We also prepared a victim notification policy. We worked with SATF and others. We had lots of numerous conversations in our state and around the country as we picked the brains of people who are ahead of us in this body of work to try and get together, quote-unquote, best practices. It is a challenging area to get it all right because there are uniquenesses with respect to each of us as human beings and what we prefer. So we've made an attempt to get it as right as we can and put it down on paper so that we're following our own policies. And then lastly, but not insignificantly, is post-conviction policy. It's not lost on me that the possibility exists that we will receive some information that surprises us. A case, for example, that had been resolved with either a plea or some such thing, that the safe kit wasn't tested, but we get a result that causes us pause. In other words, it's somebody that we didn't expect. What do we do with that? And the answer is it's our duty, it's our obligation to examine that and to look into that and understand it. It is important that to the extent, even the remote possibility that we have a mistake was made and someone pled to an offense that they did not commit, we will fix it. We put together a policy, several page policy. I have another, I guess, if you will, a fourth leg to this stool, although he's not assigned to the project, but I have a post-conviction deputy. I have someone who does this body of work. His name is Russ Ratto, who is assigned to do just post-conviction related work. And as a result, he helps me and the team to write this policy about making sure that we take care of business in that area if we have a result that causes us that we don't expect. So now on the law enforcement side, the Portland Police Bureau is doing a great job. They put together an investigative unit, detective advocacy support that supports my advocate, together with the program manager, Susan Lehman. They're just doing an outstanding job as these results come back to our jurisdiction and we begin to do what in many instances is that subsequent follow-up. What does this mean? I should probably stop. I have a sense that I've talked a lot. So I'm going to stop and see if there are any questions or also hand it over to Mr. Gardner here.
It's hard to shut up a lawyer sometimes.
Yeah.
So Representative Peluso and members of the task force, my name is Alex Gardner, and I know we're about 40 minutes or so into this presentation. So if you could give me a time, I'll conform.
10 minutes?
Okay. I'll do it. So you have in front of you a safe kit. Task Force notes. It's one of the documents, and the top page is a sort of down and dirty summary of the things I thought the group might be interested in. The first heading is OSP Labs by the Numbers, to give you a sense of what the total volume across all disciplines is. At the bottom of that first caption, it shows the DNA backlog. You can see in September of 2015, we had 784 cases in backlog status. Now we're at about 533. We're making progress against the backlog. Frankly, that's a little bit of a surprise because as more people come on board, they have to be trained. The training for a DNA analyst at the state police takes about a year. And when you go into that training process, you're basically pulling somebody who's an actively producing scientist off the bench to train. It's just like FTEP in law enforcement. So your productivity actually drops. The next category down is Danny Grant Safe Kit reviews. We've received, as of yesterday afternoon, a total of 335 cases. Of those, 133 were lost to negative Y screen. So basically what that means in our process is we screen for the presence of male DNA, and if there is none, that falls away. Obviously that's not our rapist, right? So of the 335, 133 were lost to negative Y screen analysis. That leaves 202 cases that are available for testing. Of those, 73 have produced no CODIS qualified profile
meaning that we weren't able to get a profile that met the criteria. Of the remaining, we had 33 profiles that were adequate. 22 have been entered into CODIS, and 96 are of the total are still in process. We're still testing them. It's important, I think, for everybody to remember that we have many DNA cases that are not safe kits. I mean, safe kit is an analysis that takes place in a particular environment in a particular form. But if we go to a homicide scene or a kidnap scene or something, and there's the biologists are taking the samples from the scene, that's a valid DNA case. I mention that because as we're talking about the prioritization process, we prioritize all DNA work based on the nature of the case. And we can go into that in more detail as we visit and work through this. But we don't differentiate between safe kits and other DNA sources in our process. Whether it came, the person was raped and it processed via safe kit or raped and processed at the scene, it doesn't matter to our lab, if that makes sense. The next category down shows OSP submitted safe kit number totals. These are cases not coming via the DANI grant, but that have come to us from various jurisdictions to our labs. And this is a summary here, but I've attached the safe kit request by status, by department. And if you look at the three pages that follow, you'll see on the top, it's 2014. So if you look in that first category of biology processing and you sort of slide your finger down to Portland Forensic Laboratory, you can see that in 2014, we had a total of 79 cases that came in to the Portland lab. If you turn the page and you look at the same agency, the same lab in 2015, there were a total of 304 cases that came in. And then if you turn the page again and do the same thing, you're going to see that to date we have had 516 cases submitted. I mention that so that you all get a sense of how dramatically the volume is increasing. I don't know where we're going to be at the end of this year, but we're roughly three-quarters of the way through the year. So I think it's reasonable to assume that we have 25% of this year's volume still coming. Senate Bill 1571 funded 9 positions, and I've identified the disciplines into which those positions were to go. And then the last category shows sort of where we are in the process. Of course, we have attrition over time. People continue to leave, move on to other activities, retire, and so on. But if you sort of look at that list from top to bottom as a conveyor belt, the vacant positions, there's nothing going on with those as of yesterday afternoon. But we have 3 posted now. 2 of those are 1571 positions. 4 people are in the interview process. The next stage is they've been through interview and they've been selected as background worthy. There's 1 1571 position there. One person has been hired. We're just waiting for assignment of the hiring date, and we've already hired 9 positions. Of those, 5 are 1571 positions. I want to emphasize that we're just now about two-thirds of the way through September. The money became available on August 1st, and it takes a long time to find these people, and it takes a long time to get them through background and hire them. So I think this group is much better informed than most folks who are looking at this from the outside. But many on the outside are thinking, well, you got approval for the money. How come we aren't seeing improvement? And the answer is we're going to see improvement probably about 18 months after these people are hired because we will go farther into the hole as we take the people off the bench to train them, and then we'll start climbing our way out as productivity jumps. And I'll leave it there. I think I'm probably close to my 10-minute mark. I speed-talked with the help of a lot of caffeine and sugar.
And that is appreciated. Thank you. Any questions?
Actually, I do have one. Captain Gardner, will this slow down the production of the state crime labs of your DNA output for other cases?
No. Well, let me say, to the extent that we're taking DNA scientists offline mm-hmm. to train new DNA scientists, yes, the overall productivity is going to decline. we're managing some of that by through overtime. So we have a grant that helps us with overtime, and we're working a fair amount of overtime, and that's basically how we've made progress against that backlog. But yes, I mean, there's no way, once a system is degraded, it's like losing half of the police force and then trying to hire everybody. You don't have anybody to train them. It takes a while to get the system functional again.
Okay. Interesting. Anything else? All right, so I believe I need to close those hearings. I don't need to close those hearings. So let's talk a little bit about a game plan for the future, and we'll try to, again, be brief on this. Would the group consider forming three small groups to identify specific issues in more detail? These groups would report back to the whole task force. And if there's other thoughts about needing to address other issues, we can handle that as well. So the couple we're thinking about, the definition, a small group to form around the definition of anonymous kits, a form to fill around kit testing and CODIS entry process, and a third around victim survivor notification and access. Is that sounding good to folks as some things to be working on outside of a boardroom? And with that, we can take your names now and put them by those lists, or check back with you in a week or two to see what might be of interest to you, or you can contact me or Chana. Yep.
Do you have the leaders already distinguished for these, or do you have to establish the leadership?
This is the first,
and then
the first you're hearing it.
Can you say them again?
You bet. The first one is the definition of anonymous kits. Second is kit testing and CODIS entry process. And third is victim survivor notification and access. And then if there's something we're missing or that you all can think of, happy to add that. Yep.
I was thinking about training for law enforcement as these things come. Maybe not just for law enforcement, but all for the responders, because this is new. And I know for the advocates at my agency, we would kind of like to know what's going on so everybody's on the same page.
I think that's a good idea.
Yep.
And I just, by way of a follow-up to that, I understand the law enforcement piece, but I would lump the advocates in together.
Okay, yeah.
I think
just
that's
training. I would say just training.
Training?
Multidisciplinary training.
Okay, gotcha. Well, I just think it's really important that there's that good relationship between law enforcement
Absolutely.
And advocates.
Absolutely.
So, thank you.
Chair, if I might, a volunteering, but then also a question. So I certainly volunteer. I want to have a participation in all three. I have an interest in all three. Certainly the one that I raised, the anonymous kit definition, I'd like to participate on. My question is, I have additional resources, and maybe some of us also do. And so when we break out into these subgroups, do we want to supplement those subgroups with, like, topic-related experts that can join?
I think that's an excellent idea. Any concerns around that?
I'm in favor of using all of Rod's resources.
At all times.
So am I. I do my best to spend as many of them as I can.
Yes. And so I'd like to personally participate in the anonymous kit definition, and then make a commitment to supplying resource, if not myself, to each of the other two groups that are getting together.
And looking at the bill, the legislature told us we also needed to examine the process for gathering the kits as well. And I think that part of what part of the point that Michelle made was that the best practice probably involves a SANE and an advocate, and that it sounds like part of that needs to be examined too, to make sure that that's happening across the state and everybody's on the same page there and qualified. And
do you think could that fall under the training aspect, or are you seeing that as a separate?
I'm actually seeing that as a separate, because the legislature did tell us that we need to examine the process for gathering and analyzing, and I'm seeing that as both scientific and who's in the room.
Okay. Is that We can add that.
I mean, it,
yep. That does make sense.
It does seem to make sense, and I'm wondering if it fits in one of the other
things. Yeah, I don't know either. I'm trying to wrap my head around it. I wonder if it goes within
testing and the, you know, the collection and the testing could go together into one group potentially.
Sure. Sure.
It's hard to separate any of them, but I do think that. So, are you talking about literally a collection of tests? Who is in the room?
That kind of stuff. I would imagine that's part of the process. That's part of the process of gathering the information in the first place, and probably really amazingly important to victims. Like, mm-hmm. Who's in the room? What are their training? You know, are those people operating under best practices as well? Trauma informed, all that stuff we talk about these days.
So I sort of think that maybe some of this could, I know you think they're different, but maybe, what was the victim survivor, the thing that you had said of the initial three?
Victim survivor notification and access.
Okay. 'Cause I'm wondering if one of the charges is improvements for training and responding to an investigating sexual assault, which could be part of what you're talking about. And I think what is ringing in my head a lot is whatever that training is or whatever this approach is, and these changes are going to affect how law enforcement, and not just law enforcement, because advocates are always there with us. Victim experience is not the right word, but basically that initial response, and I think that could be an aspect of this that reports back. And the reason I say this is I think whatever, I don't know if this is nuts, I'm just talking out loud, but I was literally wondering if part of this response would be, the reality is I think in a lot of places, if you look in a geographical estate, you're going to get a different response in particular areas. And so some sort of standardization is probably going to be good for victims and I think for everybody involved. So whether or not that was some kind of a standard statement, a standard victim bill of rights, I'm just talking out loud here. But however we clarify for everybody up front that in this state there's a new set of rules about, we're taking out subjectivity for the testing of kits. So how do we communicate to the victim that the odds are better if we start an investigation now? I'm not saying that subjectively. I think if you ask most investigators or anybody that the time to collect evidence, if you forgot anything else, is right now. But how do you convey that without somehow coercing a victim to do something they're not ready to do? You know, so there's so many pieces to this. Even saying to victims, you don't have to participate in this. It's going to be an anonymous kit, but we are going to test what we're about to take from you. So.
And my professional job is different than anybody else's here at this table. And my job really is to make sure that the system works properly when you've got an identified defendant and that person has been charged. And my job can be when I look at I defend sexual assault cases. I defend children charged with sexual assault. I do dependency work with children who have been victims of sexual assault. Okay, so I've got kind of this umbrella experience. But when I'm defending a case, the first thing I look at is, were things done properly? What are the best practices in that realm? Were those best practices followed? And where did somebody screw up? So that's why I'm bringing this up, is because if we can put best practices together that are followed across the state, people think I'm interested in getting criminals loose. I'm not. I'm interested in making sure that Rod's office gets the right people. And that my clients' rights are respected. That folks from the Oregon State Crime Lab have done their job properly. I mean, I'm really kind of a quality control technician, right? Sometimes I call myself a due process technician.
I agree with you.
I'm struggling with how do we make this beginning piece so that everybody knows what they're doing and I can't screw with it later, right?
I think the more we talk about it, we really have to identify three different training areas, one of which is the initial response. So So officers who are initially responding to a sex assault allegation, what training and experience do they have, especially being trauma-informed, as well as then the follow-up investigations from detectives, what level of training do they have? And then, of course, then you have the collection piece with the SANE nurses. So I think you break it out into the three different areas as to kind of focusing on the training aspects of it. And you know, we can talk, I think it's probably the subcommittees that are being discussed, but I think you can break that out into three different areas and have those committees move forward with some recommendations to focus on those three areas. Chair Paluso, while I'm kind of talking a little bit, I'd love to be part of that definition portion of that. So this is George. I'd love to be part of the definition committee as well as the, I'm trying to remember what the second one was, but the collection and testing, I think.
Right, kit testing and the CODIS entry process is the second. Victim,
correct.
Survivor, and notification and access. And then we've added training for responders, and I love the three areas you identified, and then a process for gathering and analyzing. And Shauna has been very gracious to will help us in summarizing what's been discussed here, and we'll send a poll out for prioritization and participation for everybody.
Decide today.
Yes. And I think it's wise that we don't decide today. Mm-hmm. We will come back in the large, the whole group, in the December legislative days, so we have a little time to get these smaller groups started. And I do recommend we see this as a beginning. These can be changed anyway and anyhow and to what best meets the needs of not just our work, but, again, out of respect for the victims, always at the highest priority. So it's nothing we need to rush. We need to do it well. We need to do it right. And to me, that's the most important aspect to it. So I don't know what the time frame was for this meeting, but I think we've extended that, and I know the group that must be waiting in my office is getting real hungry, but that's okay. But I really appreciate many familiar faces and meeting new folks around this. I thank you for some confidence in me being able to chair. I have that confidence because I'm sitting next to Shauna. But we'll make this happen, and we'll be in touch again with the how these next steps will go forward. And any other questions or comments that people want to add? Again, thanks to the dedication to this really important task. It is greatly, greatly appreciated. So with that, I get to hit the gavel. We're done.
Thank you. Great job. Great job.